This is the Convo Podcast. Brought to you by Boom Buzz Nigeria.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
People who don't know will not know that you and I have a relationship that predates the documentary.
Very much so.
And I've said that if there's anybody that is imminently qualified to do this documentary, the Afrobeats Backstory documentary, it is you.
Okay.
My own question is, why did it take this long?
Well, it has to take this long because it's a documentary over time. Normally, you can do a documentary about something that happened last week or an event, just like maybe, you know, a social event. You can do a documentary. You can do a documentary about a wedding that happened last week. But this one had to take this long because it's the development, it's the foundation, it's the history, it's the building, it's the refining, and, you know, it has to go through all those processes to come to this point. So it's not something that can be done in a couple of years or 2 years. In fact, I believe that I was there at the beginning, not necessarily right at where the spark happened, but I believe that I was there at the beginning, and that's how I based the whole chronological order of the documentary from when I came into music in 1999. And then when I started doing the documentary itself and I started asking people questions, I found out that 1999 was the year that things actually started to blossom as well. So it's you can put it in outtakes. I'll take it from 1999. So I now found out that 1999 was the same year that things started to blossom for a lot of other people as well. Of course, in the beginning, when I say the beginning, not 1999, in the beginning of when things start to change, it was in 1999. It was the prelude to 1999 was people like Junior and Pretty. In fact, it was I could say people like them, Dizzy K, Falola,
right?
You understand?
Yeah.
Or even Shino Peters. Because if you trace back and think about who are the first rappers in Nigeria.
So Shino says the SSP says is a lot.
Oh, no. It's a fact. It's a fact.
Because it was rapping in
Shinomania.
Was it Shinomania?
It's not experience, Shinomania. That's his experience.
His experience.
Okay.
His experience. Mm-hmm. But we'll go on song.
Yeah.
So yes, to your point, right? I understand that a lot of things had built up until 99.
Yes, but 99 was when I believe the from all the directions. 99 was the crossroads that things just blew up, because that was when people like Tribesmen, Remedies, and Plantation Boys kind of like blew up, you understand, and became. So those three boy bands sparked off what we have today, because they had singing, which is pop, they had rap, they had Yoruba, they had indigenous. Is that what it's called? Indigenous or
indigenous?
Indigenous.
Right.
Okay. They had native language. Right. They had rap. They had melody. They had pop. They had dancehall, kind of like, you know, blackface was was getting into. Right. So basically, they had everything within those three boy bands. You understand? So, and they had Idris Abdul Karim, which is, which was kind of like very new then. And, you know, Rugged Man was saying he was speaking nonsense, but that nonsense that he was speaking was exciting to us.
Right.
For me, I actually enjoyed it. It's part of the sing along of the song. Mm-hmm. When you listen to Mio Shakomo or listen to Sade. Yeah, exactly. We look forward to that part so we can do that.
For you, it had to be something of a. I'm looking for the right way to frame it now. Now, you grew up in parts here.
I grew up in Nigeria.
You grew up in Nigeria.
Yeah, I grew up in Lagos.
You grew up From when you got back till you went back to school, like how long was that?
13 years.
13 years, so that was pretty much your formative. Because I was going to say that you must have been exposed to a better way or a more sophisticated way of doing music at the time than what we were doing.
Yeah, but that's the thing. At that age, I wasn't really into music like that. Music for me then was inspiration. Fella, you understand? Everything I do, everything I have created, all my productions, pretty much even how I even live my life in terms of consciousness is influenced and inspired by Fela Anikula Kokuti. Like I totally live that Fela, you know, mentality and ideology. So, and it was from his music. A little bit of his lifestyle as well, but it was from his music. But you see, the music is what got me here. And I'm even surprised that I did not even go into music earlier, even like as an artist, you understand? So it was that inroad into music that made me started, you know, that kicked off the how shall I put it, what's the word? I won't say interest. It's more than an interest.
Right.
The religion. So it's like music is religion for me.
Okay. So now, you got into music courtesy or by the way of managing a Fuji act, K1 The Ultimate.
Yes.
How did that happen? Because, you know, K1 at the time, K1 was already king, even though there were a couple of people older than him. But he was the biggest star.
But the king is not by age though.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. So how did that connection happen for you? That what was that conversation? What was the process that led to you managing K1 and working with him for 5 years?
I don't know if I've told you this story before. I was doing a documentary a couple of years after I left law school. I was doing a documentary. I had a film degree already, so I was doing a documentary on Femi Kuti, and it was from that documentary and a friend of mine, Jimmy the bald-headed guy. We did the documentary together. He was taking pictures for Ovation magazine and I was filming. And he knew K1 The Ultimate, Kwamwon. Was you are in the, It was, in fact, it was around that time that he changed his name to Kwamwon. So he knew him and he was taking pictures for him for Ovation as well and everything. So I think they were talking about something one day and he said, look, I have a friend that is doing a documentary with Femi right now. After I finished that one, would you like him to do a documentary? So just send something to Nigeria, you know, London and everything. And then he invited me. I remember the first day that I met him. Well, I've met him before, but not formally.
Right.
I went to his wife's office, Alpha, and we sat down. And then he now recognized me from my film, King of My Country. So that was like the sort of like, Igboloshe film, yeah, that kind of thing. So, and it was very, very, we became friends very, very quickly. And, you know, been to his house and everything. So anyway, we did the documentary and then there was a couple of issues that he wanted to sort out, you know, legally, like contracts and stuff like that. I helped him look at this contract. So I did that for him. And then, of course, like I said, we became friends. So he now said, why don't you become my lawyer or my manager and everything. And he asked me in July or August, and I didn't accept until like November because I taught myself like music management. I've never done music management before, and especially Fuji music. And you know, I asked my mom, I asked my wife, you know, it's one of those things that you are like, okay, oh. And you know how they say it in Yoruba, you know, that's what they want to tell you, I'm only Fuji. But you know, we talked about it, and I told him, I gave him my terms, we agreed on terms, and I said, while we're doing this thing, I'm going to be filming, you know, like I'm going to be filming everything. And he said, yeah, like, you know, no problem. And that's how we started. So really, this documentary about Afrobeat started with Fuji Music. It was after I finished with Wasu. In fact, it was during that, during when I was managing Wasu that I met them, Tribesmen.
Right.
And then I kind of like started informally managing them when I'm in Lagos until I became their manager after Wasu and everything. Yeah, so that was how everything kind of like germinated.
Right, so now you've done Wasu. And again, on the other hand, I have a theory that Fuji underlines modern Nigerian music. You can't, it's hard to take away the Fuji influences and elements of our modern music.
Well, when you say our modern music, are you talking about all music or music from the Southwest? Because in the North,
right,
Fuji has its origins in Were. Ajiwere, which is like Islamic,
yes,
chanting and yeah, wailing, yeah, when they are doing fasting.
Right.
So then you can say all the stuff that they do in the North as well can be, yeah. But you see, they don't do Fuji in the North. They do Islamic music. Mm-hmm. Like if you watch these Hausa films, when they have like their musical breaks, mm-hmm, it's always very, yeah. So it's like Islamic music. But Islamic music in the Southwest is Ajiwere. And then it now sort of led into praise singing and then all whatnot. Asha, not to worry.
Now, you've been pretty much recording for films since 99 that you started working with Kimo.
I've been recording before 99, but I started this particular recording with Wasu in 99.
In 99.
Yes.
Mm. So this is some 20 plus years.
Well, 20 years. It was going to be, I didn't know I was going to be involved in music for 20 years when I started. Mm-hmm. I just thought, okay, my initial contract with Wasu was for 2 and then I renewed and then, you know, but I didn't know that I was going to be involved in music for, I just thought it was something fun. I could travel around the world, you know, hang out with Wasu Ayinde, you know, have fun, make money and go back home. I didn't know this was going to hold me for 20 years.
You know, it was going to be your entire life.
It I didn't know it was going to be a career for me. It was something that I wanted to just do for fun, simply because I wanted to be recording. You understand? I thought, okay, well, after the 2 years, because my initial contract was for 2 years, after the 2 years, I'll have some footage that I can put something out.
And then just let on and on.
And then probably go back to my law practice or keep on making film.
Right.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was going to hook me for 20 years.
And it's funny because if you list Nigerian artists, at least since about 99, there's hardly one who does not, in a way, trace back to you.
Somebody, right?
So
somebody.
We could do a family tree.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to say,
up until when did Dr. Sid get married? Was it 2003 or 2004? I don't remember.
Dr. Sid.
His wedding was 2003 or 2004. 13, not 3, yes, 2013. So, I used to say before that time that I am connected to everybody in the music industry except Timaya.
Right.
And that day I met Timaya at Dr. Seed's wedding. It was Tunde Ednot that introduced me to Timaya, and we hung out. And I think I posted something on Instagram. I said, now I know everybody in the industry. But you know, a funny story, backstory about Timaya as well. Backstory about Timaya. When I came to Lagos to sign contracts with Idris Abdul Karim to take him to London for our 2004 show, I told them that, look, I only have 4 spaces. So it's you, your manager, and 2 other people, whether it's dancer, backup singer, like I can't afford to take more than 4 people. So he said, okay, fine. So I was dealing with the manager, God bless his soul, Dakwa Arogundade, that's his name. So the day that I came back to collect the list and passport numbers, they gave me 8 names. So they gave me 8 names and I'm like, guy, I said 4. Why are you giving me 8 names? So I just took a pen. When I saw, in fact, the manager put his name first before Idris. You understand? So I just saw Idris and the manager's name and I just drew a line under the 4th name. Like, so it was 10-10, and so I drew a line under number 4, like, these are the 4 that I'm going to take. But guess who the number 5 was? It was Timaya. So if I had taken 5, I'd have met Timaya. And funny enough, maybe his life will have taken a completely different turn, but
yeah,
you know, right. that's life.
Yeah. So the larger picture is, now there's this Ayoshonaya guy who has worked with pretty much everybody,
yes,
and continues to make that work in that space.
Yes.
Were you at any point concerned that we were not documenting our history?
I wasn't concerned, I was documenting it.
Okay, so apart from that,
I would have thought somebody would be doing something similar. You understand? Maybe from another angle, or maybe from another, like, okay, I knew Tony Tetsuila and to some point Idris Abdul Karim, and I knew them Tribesmen. So that's two out of the three boy bands. I didn't meet, funny enough, I met Two Face for the first time on the day that we were traveling to London with Idris Abdul Karim. I met him on that, and I said to him, if Emorobe introduced him to me, and he said, this is Two Face, I've seen you before. Excuse me. If Emorobe introduced Two Face to me, and I said, okay, of course, I know who you are, Plantation Boys, I've seen you, you know, open for Naughty by Nature and all these people, you know, I know who you are. He now said he has just gone solo and he has just signed for Kenny's Music. And I'm like, okay, cool. Next year, 2005, I am going to take you to London. And we almost did. I mean, that's another backstory. Because what we used to do was take one group and one solo artist. So 2003 was Tony Tetuila as a solo artist, and then we took Tribesmen. In 2004, we took Maintain as a group and Idris Abdul Karim. And 2005, it was going to be Two Face and Olufunmi
Style Plus.
Yes, and we almost did. So that was when I met Two Face. I met him on the day that we were going to London with Idris Abdul Karim.
Right. So Afrobeat's the backstory.
Yes.
What was the timeline? When did you start recording up until now that you're premiering?
Recording the interviews.
Okay, so you've had the interviews.
Yeah, I've had the interviews. You see, the funny thing about it.
Did you set out to make this is what it's going to be, or you had several interviews that got you that, oh, I could piece all of these things together?
Let me tell you about with documentaries, right? There's two ways you can approach it. Sometimes you can just be filming over time and hope that a story will come out, and it will be the content that you have will give you a story to tell. And then the other way is you were just recording for prosperity, and then you now look at it and say, ah, I can make a documentary out of this thing. My own case was the former. I was recording to make a documentary, another documentary for WASU. But I just kept on recording and recording. So I didn't know when this recording would stop and I would collate it and everything. So I had recorded interviews, and it just got to a point I thought, okay, what am I going to do with all this footage now? And because I was about to retire, like right now, officially,
I'm from
music.
What? How? Why?
Because I'm done 20 years. Music is a diversion for me. So I've done 20 years in this diversion. So I'm back on my main road now, which is filmmaking, which is part of, I mean, I studied filmmaking, and my discipline was actually documentary filmmaking. So back to your question, what I did was I said, okay, I have this, I have that. What can I now do to firm it up? So say for example, the first time I met Kaffi the dancer, I met her at Hip Hop World office. Actually, they didn't have an office then. They were using one hotel room somewhere in Abiola Gardens. And I met her, and Ayo Animasha introduced her and said, this is the girl that was in the Baby Scare Scare video. Of course, we were in London doing intro. So I said, okay, we've played the video. You are the girl that was dancing and everything. So I said, Abbas, let's do an interview for this girl. Let's just help her, you know, blow it up and whatever. And then when we did the interview, in fact, the interview was very, very impromptu. We just went downstairs to the parking lot in the hotel and we did a full 1 hour interview. And I just realized that this girl has so much ambition. This girl has so much drive. This girl was looking forward. She already, you know, she was talking about everything Kaffi is doing today. She was talking about it back then in 2005, 2006. You understand? She was saying, I'd like to build a company, a dance company. I'd like to, you know, with that same verve. So Kaffi was the catalyst for me to do interviews with people I've interviewed back in the days. Like if you watch Kaffi's segment in the documentary, I mixed that interview with now.
Oh, wow.
You understand? So especially when she was telling me about how she started, it's the same story how she started and then updated with what she's done since we interviewed her. So I was cutting it sort of like, you know, yeah. I cut it together, the same story. But you can see that Kaffi is saying it when she was young and and then now when she's like, no, she's still not reserved, but she's older now and everything. So back to your question. The moment I decided to start collating, doing interviews and putting out the documentary was when I went to watch the video at O2 Arena. I looked around and I saw that we had 20,000 people, full house at the O2 Arena, big venue. I mean, this is one of the biggest venues, you know. When we used to do shows, we used to get 2,000 capacity and we used to feel so happy. This is 10 times that 2,000 capacity. I'm like, okay, this is the right time. Not even knowing that Grammy was even going to come with Burna Boy. I'm like, this is the right time to do this documentary about the rise of Afrobeats. And it took me 2 years to complete it. And now putting it out, Burna Boy and Wizkid have won Grammy. So everything is timely.
Just fell into place.
Everything just fell into place.
How do you, because you mentioned Kaffi now, right? And you have all of those people who started out really young and grew up with them. And
some of us are still young.
My question. How do you feel in a way gratified to see all of these people having success and enjoying?
Absolutely. I will tell you, people like Kaffi. Kaffi is one of the people that I'm very, very proud of. I am very, very proud of that girl, because it's one thing to say things and speak it into existence. It's another thing to make it happen. And Kaffi has made it happen even more. She just got a honorary PhD. You understand? So, Jimmy Jatt, Ayo Animashan, these are the OGs in the industry. Kaffi is one of the OGs. You understand? Ayo Animashan, Obi Asika. These are people that I met back like 99, 2000, and they're kind of like, and we didn't know that this thing that we were doing then was going to become this big. So, in a way, for me, I wanted to represent those people. I wanted to show people like, okay, these people are still around though. Obi is still there. He's doing one TV. Yeah, Obi is there. Jimmy is there.
Right.
My partner, DJ Abbas in London, JJC. People don't understand the importance of JJC. JJC is a very important part of the Afrobeat story, because back in 99, he had something that he was pushing called, you know, JJC is like was a big star in England with Big Brothers. Yeah, they had like top 10 single, right. They traveled the world. Yeah, soundtrack for Scooby-Doo, like every, yeah. So, but JJC wanted to be doing something that he called Afropean. I mean, the word Afropean did not take off, but he wanted to be putting Afro in front of everything. Afro. You know, he did the song, We Are Afro. Yeah, so, you know, JJC was very, very African. When JJC speaks English, back then, he speaks the Fone British, but when he speaks Yoruba, he sounds like his Yoruba is not even refined. You understand? Hold on a minute. Corey, we can hear you. Do you want to go out? Sorry, that's my son. He's going with me. Yeah, but the thing is, just go and do it outside. Don't worry, it will make for good outtakes.
I'll tell you.
Yeah, so, shush, please. Do you just go outside? Eddie, just take him outside.
Don't worry, sir.
Okay. So, in England, JJC is one of the people that were the foundations. It was the foundation of anything Afri or Afro. You understand? He was comfortable doing his pop music, making music, top of the pops, all this, you know. But he wanted to do something African. And for some reason, I mean, that's part of his story, they wouldn't let him do any African. So he left the group. He left the group that he pretty much started.
Yeah.
You understand?
That's Big Brothers,
yeah. He left the group. Like, if you don't want me to do this, and for him to leave the group, I think what he wanted to do was, I'll take my group. And they said, okay, well, we like the way the group is going. If you want to leave, you can leave. But they had to pay him off because contractual and everything. So he now used that money that he got to buy a building, build a studio, and gather a new group, 419 Squad, Shady Blue, Flu, what's this guy that I used to call the band Ski Bunch, Stylo G, and all these people, like Jamaican, African. He started a movement in England because he had the money. Like, he lived at the top of the building, and the middle floor was the studio, and then the ground floor is kind of like reception. And it's from that studio that people like Don Jazzy, D'Banj came out. You understand? Master Plan, that did Pata Pata. You know, he's an original member of 419 Squad, yes, and everything. So GJC was a leader of men, and he had the foresight, although he was calling his own Afropean music, right, like Africans in Europe. Yeah. You understand? But you know, the name didn't catch on, but JJC is one of the foundations diaspora.
JJC is in the documentary.
Absolutely, absolutely. And JJC used to, I mean, the way I found JJC, because we were just looking for videos, and when we realized that JJC is in Nigeria from Big Brothers, there's another guy in Big Brothers called Tayo, who is the younger brother to Kiskirin. Kiskirin is a party planner, is a friend of ours. So we said, okay, this guy's in Nigeria, let's play his Big Brother video. And he said, but I have 419, I have this, I have that. I'm like, give us all the videos. That's when they did the video for RTD. Big Brothers today. So when he did that today, we played that video and we invited him to intro. It was then that we started talking, and JJC will now try to learn from me. Like, he said he wants to be directing his own videos. He wanted to be, you know, like, you know, which is what he's doing now. He said he wanted to be directing his own videos. So, you know, we would now, you know, it's kind of like JJC is just an important part, as important as the program that we were doing called Intro, because that was the first program for black music, not even African music, the first program for black music in the UK, even before MTV Base came to UK. So yeah, so I'm taking the story from Nigerian foundation, UK foundation, and then the ones I didn't know about, which is the Ghanaian part, I had to go to Ghana to go and find out.
So, you know, you have this wide-reaching, important project that takes on all of the music of different places and different people. I'm going to ask you about a couple of people, right, which you've had interactions with and all whatnot. Just your thoughts and maybe just a story we didn't know about them before. D1.
My guy. When I was starting out in TV, I just posted something now. Today is his birthday. I said when I was starting out in TV, I wanted to be like D1. Is that Rain?
Yes.
Wow. Is it going to change our...
No, it's not.
Okay. D1 is somebody that I admire a lot. A lot of people say we look alike. You know, Fine Boy at Station of Nigeria. And... but I... Even though I watch him and... Baba Keke... Kenny Ogunbe, I like D1 because of his swag. You understand? You know when, you know, it's like when you like another man or when you admire another man, like, I would like, you know, like me, I would like to be like that guy. It's like when you're 10 years old or 11 years old, you say, I would like to be like Muhammad Ali, I would like to be like, you know, but that's me. So when I got a chance to do TV in England, I said to Abbas, we are going to do a program just like Primetime Jams or AIT Jams. Like, you would take on the Kenny Ogunbe persona, I would take on D1. And we will play it off like that. I mean, we beat off a lot of their concepts as well. We started going to the Grammys as well. We started doing the off the cuff. Because they don't rehearse their show or produce their show.
Yeah.
But what they were doing looked like it was unrehearsed,
yes,
and it was free. And that is how I want my program to be. We can talk about anything, we can laugh at, you know, so we don't have to be, what do you call it, too rigid. Exactly. We want it to be loose, we want it to be free, we want it to appeal to young people, you understand, even though we were young-ish then, we were in our 30s. And really, yeah, D1 is somebody that I wanted to be like. And then when I met him, our spirits just connect. Our spirits connect. The day I met D1 at a function at Obalende Suya, we were sitting across the table from each other. Our eyes caught each other. I gave him that universal black man salute. Like, you know, he gave it to me too. And then after, when we were having dinner, I moved to his table, and I, you know, talked to him, like, you know, and he was like, and then he now recognized me. Don't forget that they were at AIT. And my film, even though we sold it, my film King of My Country, when I did it in 1996, was played on AIT till at the, I hear that the tape basically spoils. I gave them that film after we had sold the video just to play for a couple of times, and I think they were playing it once a week, which gave me a lot of exposure. So he recognized me, and then from then I was the one that, you know, with my car, I went to drop him where he, you know, and then we went out later that night and we became friends. You understand? So D1 is my mentor, my friend, and my ego.
Best in the donation.
Ooh. Okay. I am a fella child. Of course, biologically, I wasn't born by fella, but I was so influenced by fella that I sorry to say this, Dad, rest in peace. I listened to fella more than my dad.
Right.
No, honestly, my dad will be my dad was very strict and everything, but fella was strict as well, but he was also a cool guy. You know what I mean? In a perverse way, I wish he was my dad. And a lot of the kids that were around Calcutta that time, whether were the children of some of his musicians or children of friends, or, you know, a lot of friends will come and their children, you know. So we see ourselves like fella's children. And I knew of Benson Adonijie. Not that he was the manager then, but I knew of him as one of these journalists from, I think, what, Guardian or something. So we know the name Benson Adonijie. It's just one of those names that, you know, like Yinka Craig or what's this guy? Frank Olise, thank you. Like people, Yori Folani, you know, like Sene or you know them as, you know. So I knew. But you know the funny thing, I didn't know that he had managed fella before. I all I knew about him was he was a journalist and he was a very hard critic. I mean, I read a lot when I was younger. One of the things that my father instilled in me was to read, and fella as well. Fella would give you books like the autobiography of Malcolm X at 12 years old, although I was younger. But he would give people like that to say, he would take the book. Fella would be arguing a point. He would now take the book, and he will now tap the book like this and say, read this book. This is the answer. This is what you need to read for that thing you're arguing with me. Yeah, to younger people. I mean, I knew people like Dele Sosimi and all these people, you know. So he would say, read this book. You understand? All these things that you're arguing with me, you will find the answer in this book. He will talk about Kwame Nkrumah. He will talk about Thomas Sankara. He will talk about all these people. Even American, you know, like, what's this guy's name? James Baldwin. Like, he would give you a book and say, read this book. So for me, I took a lot from fella. So back to Benson Adonijie, I didn't know that he had managed fella. It was until later, even after I'd grown up in my teens, that I realized that Benson Adonijie had. And I met him one time again at the Guardian when I went to visit Steve Ayoride. And I think they were doing something. I don't know if Uncle Benson was still working at Guardian then, but he was at the Guardian. They were doing something, Sha. So Steve Ayoride invited me. So I went and I met him and I talked to him briefly that, me too, I'm a fella picking, and, you know. And he just said, okay, nice, you know, and that was it. It was not until last year when I interviewed him for the documentary that we did a catch up. Because if you watch the Benson Adonijie part of the documentary, apart from him talking about fella, which was very, 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 very insightful, and I thank him for that. And then we talked about Burna Boy as well. We talked about music in general. We talked about music in general, and he was still his very, very hard self as a critic. So when we now finished the interview, we now started to talk fella. And we now realized that when I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, we were in the same place together. It was a very, you know, I said, we were mentioning, you know, when you enter fella's house, you know, fella's gate man, the bodyguard, fella had like a pet monkey, you know, where he parked his cars. Like, we were so vivid in our recollection. We were so vivid in our recollection of that fella time. Like, where he parked his cars, his Range Rover, with the fella Africa 70 emblem on the side, you know. And you know, fella used to do crazy things. He used to try to show you that it's vanity upon vanity. Mm. As in, like, the Benz that people were driving that day, that people were... Fella had a Benz that he turned it into a convertible.
Wow.
Fella was mad as shit. He actually cut the head of the Benz, and that's the Benz, like, I think it was the 280, whatever, the double bumper one.
Yes.
He used to send people to go and buy firewood.
So what's the myth? Because I heard this just when I was growing up. Like,
oh, but I used to do crazy shit. He had a Beetle that didn't have seats. I don't know whether they took the seats, out intentionally,
right,
or whatever. There was no seats. The person driving the Beetle was sitting on block. You know, the building blocks. It was such a crazy, you know, fella used to do a lot of stuff just to show people that, look, it's just money. All this Range Rover that we're driving now, they were thinking we were feeling cool. Fella had like maybe four. Fella had money, and he had that. Him and Sonny Okosun were like the kings of Swulele, right, then. See, Sonny Okosun lived at the end of Inobi Street, Ikate. He had a dune, right, buggy. You know what a dune buggy is? It's one of those quad cars that they drive on the beach, right, just four-wheel drives. Yes. When I met Sonny Okosun in 2005, and I did an interview with him. I went to his house in that Yaya Abatom, whatever, in that church. And I was telling him this story. He looked at me, he said, you really know me well. I said, we used to hail you when you drive past in that dune buggy.
Right.
That dune buggy was made for the beach, not for a road. He now said, he said all the superstars, they don't know how to do superstar. He said that dune buggy, when he did a show in Brazil,
right,
he bought that dune buggy.
Wow.
And then he said he flew it back on the same flight as his excess luggage. So as he was landing from Brazil, the dune buggy was landing as well, and he rode it all the way from the airport. He said, these young boys, they don't know how to do superstar. Anyway, back to Benson and Donnie.
Yes, yes.
Back to Benson and Donnie. So we now sat down and we talked about everything. And even I still speak to him now.
Oh, wow.
I have spoken to Benson and Donnie more times,
right,
than ever.
Yeah.
Because I've only spoken to him like maybe once or twice before we did the interview. But now, and then after we did the interview, his wife, Bona's mom's mother, Bona's grandmother, she now said, "Hey, ni she interview emi no ni. Emi no no one stories in first of you."
Oh wow!
I said, "Okay, mommy." And I start. Although we already packed up cameras.
Yeah.
I said, "Don't worry. When Bona wins the Grammy, I will come back and interview you." So I sat down with mommy, and mommy now started telling me fella stories that I did not even know about.
Mm.
She was in charge of. This is an exclusive I'm giving you.
Yes.
She was in charge of getting a place in Surulere for fella's girlfriends.
Mm.
She said that was her job, so that fella would now come and visit his girlfriends at the place. So that was her own job. And then she told me how she used to fight with Uncle Benson, you know, when they would now go off, and she would know that they've been naughty. You understand? So she in the meanwhile, Uncle Benson was sitting down and said, just be telling your own stories. And we were speaking Yoruba.
Oh wow.
Yeah, because you know, it's better like that. So yes. I told her I'm gonna come back and do that interview. Yes.
Final question I'm asking about.
Yes. Oh, final question, are we done?
No, final question I'm asking about. Yeah, we'll wrap up shortly.
Ah, okay. No, I'm enjoying this. So
exactly.
1 hour care, kill and low. Card will lose card, you want it, Tony?
No, 47 minutes.
Oh wow.
That's low.
Yes.
Card will end low. She SD near BHD.
SD.
Ah, okay. To be normally 26 minutes. No matter how to be 4K and shoot.
Aha. OJB.
Ele ma dungon. Eh, yes.
OJB and his wife that.
Korede.
Korede.
OJB. OJB Jezreel. God bless his soul.
Amen.
One of the founders of this sound. This sound,
yes.
Because he was the first one, apart from him doing the whole hip hop, you know, the normal hip hop, he had the idea to fuse Fuji and hip hop, which resulted in the song Raise the Roof by Jazz Manalofe. When I interviewed him back then, Of course, I can't interview him now. But when I interviewed him back then, me and Abbas, he said a lot of things. And two things from what he said in that interview, which you see in the documentary. He talked about, he said, Fuji is our own rap or our own hip hop. He said, this Fuji is a culture. It's not just a music genre. He said that. He said that's why he wanted to fuse Fuji and hip hop, which resulted in the song. Jazz Malofi was sitting next to him. The next thing he said was royalties. As far back as then, he talked about royalties. He said in other countries, producers get royalties, and which is true. But he said in this country, you don't get royalties. They treat you as part of the furniture. You understand? So once they collect your beat, and he is such a nice guy that he will make beats for everybody. He has made beats for everybody.
Yeah.
And when I say everybody, I mean like everybody. You make beats for them, put it out. If the song hits, pay me. Obviously, some people did not pay him, and then also he did not get royalties. So it wasn't like he wasn't conscious of it. He was conscious of it, but he said there was a time that he spoke to a few people at P-Man, that let's go to the next P-Man general meeting or whatever and table our grievances about publishing rights, royalties, and everything. And everybody was like, yeah. He said the day that he came, he said when he got there, he looked left, he looked right, there was nobody. They didn't want to rock the boat. So he just lost his, mojo there and everything. And it's so sad that this is a guy that produced a lot of artists, started their careers and produced some of the biggest songs, and he wasn't able to enjoy the fruits of his labor, his royalties, before he died. Which brings us to Korede, who is his wife, one of his wives. Korede was the original Kokolette. When we came with them, Dibanj, to first of all do a showcase at Toyin Street, White House, with Dibanj, Don Jazzy, when we only just had two songs, Bobolo Omo and Make I Tell Them to Coco, Tungolo. We got some dancers together, and she was one of the dancers. She danced so hard that day. I mean, that's not the reason why we named them Kokolette. The name Kokolette came up in when we went to go and do a Guinness show in Port Harcourt. We were talking about Bonnie M. You know Bonnie M with his the three wives.
Yeah.
So there were three dancers. So the band was like, I'll be Bonnie M and everything. I'm like, okay. So in order to be, the dancers. Yeah. And then because of the Make I Tell Them the Coco, we just came up with that name, Kokolette. So there was Kokolette 1, which was, I think, Bisola or Busola. Kokolette 2, which was Lanre, and I've forgotten she's a girl with, no, Tunde. This girl called Tunde. I remember her because she has a male name.
Right.
Yeah, and then the other girl, I've forgotten the other name, I think it was Funke or something. So those were the three. But the original Kokolette, which is the first dancer,
right,
was Korede, because they used to call her Coco. That's what they call her. They still call her that today. That's the name of her food business as well. Plug, plug. So Korede is the one now that is pushing for OJB's royalties and to keep his spirit and his name and legacy alive. But she is in the documentary as well. And she was also one of the first professional dancers. Her, even before Kaffi. But Kaffi just kind of like blew out because of Baby Skeske. Korede did Maintain in India. She did the Osho Bamba, Osho Free. She did a lot of and there's some videos that they actually did together. But it's just that Kaffi just kind of like blew up like that because of her drive and her verve. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Okay, as we wrap it up now, you know, we trace so many stories from Benson Donnie to Kenya Dimon. For somebody who didn't live in that era, and there's a lot of them now, right? What's the one thing you want them to take away from watching Afrobeats documentary? The backstory.
I don't want them to take one thing away. I want them to take many things away. I want them to take history. I want them to take facts, because I present the story with video evidence. You understand? And from the mouths of people that were there. It's not just me telling the story. I'm telling my own part of the story and I'm creating a link, but most of the stories were told by the people that were there. So I want them to take away history, learn the history, learn facts. You know, when people go on Twitter now and just be tweeting nonsense and say Kinikon was the first, Kinikon was the, you will learn the facts, unless you can disprove it, which I found very hard. I mean, this documentary is open to criticism It's open to review. It's open to fact check. It's open to anything. I was. Steve Aronide told me that after this documentary, you have to go and you have to do a seminar or a symposium where people will now pick out things in the documentary and ask you about it, and you will give them. I'll do it. As far as I know, if you prove me wrong, I'll go and re-edit. You understand? But I've done enough research. And apart from doing research, I was there. You understand? I saw it happen. So I want them to take history, education, enjoyment, and good vibes.